here and now. In a moment, new fighting words from the White House towards Iran. But first, the shadows of Iran and Iraq are looming large over talks Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is having with Arab leaders in the Middle East. Today, Rice announced a summit in the coming weeks on creating a Palestinian state. But a Jordanian newspaper is accusing the Bush administration of putting the Iraqi cart before the Palestinian horse in all of its regional diplomacy. Well, Washington Post diplomatic correspondent Glenn Kessler is traveling with Rice. We reached him earlier today as he boarded a plane to Saudi Arabia. We asked him if a date has been set for that Israeli-Palestinian-U.S. summit.
No, there's no date yet, and in fact, they're being very careful to call it a meeting, not a summit. It would involve Secretary Rice along with Prime Minister Ehud Olmert of Israel and the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. The Israelis are calling it a pre-negotiation. The Americans hope that it would kind of break the ice more between the two leaders, both of whom are very weak politically, and maybe start them talking on a broader discussion that would allow them to at least sketch the contours of a Palestinian state.
Well, tell us about that perceived weakness. Mahmoud Abbas, of course, his Fatah faction fighting with the Hamas-led government, Ehud Olmert being criticized within his own government. How powerful are they seen?
They're both very weak. The latest opinion poll for Olmert showed he had an approval rating of 14%. That is just astonishing for any leader. And it will make it very difficult for him to, kind of make promises or commitments. Same with Abbas. He is president, but the legislature is run by Hamas. And he has been trying to put together a unity government that would give him the tools to begin negotiations. But those talks have gone nowhere for a year.
Tell us more about what Condoleezza Rice is hearing as she travels through the region from these governments, many of which are Sunni-led. And in her discussions about Iraq, which is a Shiite-led government, what kinds of issues are coming up?
Well, first of all, we're leaving Egypt right now, where she had her first substantial discussion about the president's Iraq plan with an Arab leader, President Mubarak. And the Egyptians came out and said they support the plan, they hope it works. She was then asked about the hanging of Saddam Hussein at a news conference here, and she went out of her way to say that she wished it had been done with more dignity, that sometimes emotions run high, but it did not reflect well on the Iraqi government. And you could see she was really trying to reach out to some of the Sunni anger at the way that hanging was undertaken.
And there were, of course, two more hangings today, and there are reports that at least in one of them, a man was decapitated. So this issue obviously is dogging her.
Yes, exactly. You know, that's why I thought her statement on how it could have been done with more dignity will be viewed significantly here in Egypt as well as in other capitals. We're about to actually leave on a plane for Saudi Arabia, where she will spend the night and have dinner with the king there. And then tomorrow we go on to Kuwait, where she will have a meeting with leaders from all the Gulf states, where Iraq will be a big issue, but also Iran, which is causing concern because many in the region here believe that Iran has become much more powerful because of the Shiite dominance in Iraq.
There were comments made over the weekend, both from White House personnel and columnists about Iran, talking about, for instance, the possibility of limited strikes. William Kristol, for instance, saying, you know, what if the U.S. needed to go into Iran to take out a bomb-making facility? Is Condoleezza Rice hearing from people that they're hearing a drumbeat about Iran?
No one in the region wants any kind of military strikes. I mean, what they want, though, is to somehow blunt their rising influence here. Whether or not you can actually get something that involves enough countries working together to prevent that influence is unclear. I mean, she has put together a grouping of six Gulf nations along with Egypt and Jordan to work together on Iran. All these countries are coming to these meetings with a fair amount of reluctance because they are quite fearful of being seen as part of an anti-Iranian alliance.
Yeah. Glenn, what is your impression of Secretary Rice as she makes this trip? We were reading that one Israeli legislator said on the radio there that, you know, the poor thing, you know, that she's hearing so many different things. What's your sense of how she's carrying this out?
Well, you know, she has a seems to be have a bottomless well of optimism. I mean, she goes. She's really come into the Middle East in a very difficult time, when there seems little progress or possibility for Middle East peace. Iraq is crumbling before our eyes. Iran has become a much more powerful country in the region, and yet she kind of plugs away at it and does it with a fair amount of enthusiasm.
Glenn Kessler covers the State Department for The Washington Post. We reached him on his cell phone as he was boarding a plane for Saudi Arabia with Secretary Rice. Well, last week, U.S. forces arrested five Iranians in Iraq, alleging they were aiding insurgents. Last night on 60 Minutes, President Bush said if the U.S. catches Iranians in Iraq harming Americans or Iraqis, you know we will deal with them. Earlier, Vice President Cheney said the threat of Iran is growing, and conservative columnist William Kristol said U.S. troops should be allowed to cross into Iran to take out bomb makers. Well, Mark Hosenball is investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Mark, what's been the reaction to all of this, especially inside a Kurdish Iraq where those Iranians were arrested?
Well, I think the Kurds are pretty unhappy at the American arrest of these people because they apparently invited the Iranians there. The Maliki government is apparently unhappy about the American actions against the Iranians who were arrested in Baghdad, and of course all these Iraqi parties have pretty good relations with Iran, and in fact leaders of those parties hung out in Tehran during the years that Saddam Hussein was in charge in Baghdad. So, you know, there's a historical relationship here between the Shia parties and the Shia leadership, and even the Kurdish leadership and the Kurdish parties in Iran going back some period of time. So it would be normal for these people to get together. On the other hand, it wouldn't surprise me at all if the Iranians are playing, at least to some extent, a malevolent role in keeping things on the boil in Iraq.
Kurdish officials told you that they felt they should at least have been alerted and informed. And how does this play into questions about the transfer of power that the U.S. is hoping to have, transferring power from the U.S. coalition forces to people like the Kurdish officials?
Well, given that Bush's latest plan, as I understand it, it heavily relies upon cooperation from not so much the Kurdish government, but the government of Maliki, putting pressure on them, we'll have to see, A, whether that works, or B, whether it backfires. It's certainly not necessarily going to help an awful lot. And, of course, we know that the Iraqi study group recommended, rather than provoking Iran and Syria, that the United States reach out to them and at least see whether there was some way that the United States could convince these countries to be more helpful.
You said a moment ago that you wouldn't be surprised to find that there was Iranian-backed violence in Iraq. There is some new intelligence on that. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, multiple intelligence officials have said, both in private and in public, that there's evidence that the Iranians are supplying weapons technology to Iraqi insurgents, that they may be supplying actual weapons to Iraqi insurgents, that they're dealing with militias and insurgent groups inside of Iraq. And, you know, I've been hearing these reports for long enough and from sources, you know, not just connected with the U.S. government sort of propaganda apparatus, that I believe that some of that is true, maybe to a significant extent.
But then what about the question that because of that, the Bush administration might be more seriously considering a military strike?
I suppose you could go over the border and root out some alleged terrorist training camp or arms depot or something in Syria or Iran without causing a regional war or without creating a total war between the United States and Iran. But you have the same problem in a military attack against Iran that you had in Iraq, which is that, you know, you can go and attack Iran. You could maybe even somehow destabilize the government there. But what are you going to put in its place? Iran is a lot bigger place than Iraq was. There's a lot more people in Iran than there are in Iraq. And, you know, I don't know too many really sensible people who think that, trying to bring down the government of Iran by military means is a very good idea. And I don't even know that many people who think that that sort of bombing Iranian nuclear facilities is a good idea, because the orthodox view in the intelligence community is if you bomb Iranian nuclear facilities, that will only probably make the Iranian government put its nuclear program further underground. It will rally all the people in Iran who don't particularly like the current religious dictatorship around that dictatorship in a nationalistic way. So military action against Iran is a very problematic thing, and I don't necessarily think that the Bush White House is on the verge of that, though they're kind of pretending to be. And I don't even sense, and we say this in our story, that the Bush administration has launched any particular campaign of covert action to try and destabilize the government of Iran. There have been some reporting that Bush is, you know, may have signed some secret order ordering the CIA or other undercover units to destabilize Iran and Syria. I actually checked into that. I couldn't find any evidence that that's true.
Well, Senator Joseph Biden, who's the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chair, asked Condoleezza Rice about this in that hearing last week and has since also sent a letter to the White House trying to get a response on that. What did
he
say?
Well, he's making a particular point. Bush did say in his speech, you know, we're going to root out these Iranian networks you know, on either side of the, he didn't say it exactly this way, but the implication was on either side of the Iraqi border with Iran. In other words, they might follow Iranian troublemakers back into Iran and blow them up or something. Biden was basically saying, do you think you have are you planning to do that? And do you think you have the authority to do that? Because as far as I'm concerned, you have no congressional authority to do that. The White House hasn't answered his questions yet. It seems to me that he has a legitimate question. I saw Congressman Murtha, you know, the Democratic leader on the Appropriations Subcommittee for Defense, saying something similar in Congress yesterday. I mean, I think a lot of this talk about chasing Iran back into Iran or Syria is just that talk. It's bluster on the part of the United States. And I think assuming that the Bush administration limits its agitation or activities against the Iranians to Iranian elements inside Iraq, they may alienate the Shiite government of Iraq, but they're not necessarily going to cause a great deal of problems in political problems in the United States. I don't think anybody really is too disturbed if the United States is going after troublemakers inside Iraq. Once the United States actually tries to go over the border, if it does, into Iran and Syria, then I think that's going to cause a bunch of political problems in Washington for the White House if they do that, because I don't think Congress is going to stand for that. But I'm not sure that they're going to do that.
Well, in fact, you when you say that it might just be blustery talk, you spoke to some anonymous administration officials who said that the thinking is that maybe it was too aggressive.
Yes, that's right. I mean, some of my colleagues did speak to officials at the White House who thought that some of this aggressive talk against Iran and Syria had backfired and had inspired what Tony Snow, the White House press secretary, in fact, described as an urban legend that Bush was about to attack Iran and Syria. And, I mean, I, at this point, tend to agree with Tony Snow that it is a bit of an urban legend. But on the other hand, they're creating this kind of rumor by such strident rhetoric against Iran and Syria, which administration officials, including the vice president, continued yesterday.
Mark Hosenball, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. His story about the question of a U.S. military strike against Iran is in the January 22nd issue. Mark, thanks.
Thank you very much.
And later on Here and Now, vlogging, video dispatches from Iraq, also teaching black classical music history, for instance, Chevalier de St. George, conductor and swashbuckler, and creating the African-American classical stars of the future. We'll learn about a program. Much more coming up Here and Now. Here and Now. Improving the health of the incarcerated has been a frequent topic of public policy discussion. But what happens to prisoners after their release? Well, a recent study followed Washington State prisoners for 4.5 years and concluded that they are 3.5 times more likely to die after release from prison than their counterparts in the non-prison population. Well, joining us now is Ingrid Binswanger, a researcher with the University of Colorado at Denver and lead author of the study, which appears in the current edition of the New England Journal of Medicine. And Dr. Binswanger, that 3.5 figure was for your whole 4.5 year study, as we said. But what did you find as a rate of death within the prison populations in their first 2 weeks after release?
In the first 2 weeks after release, inmates who were coming out of prison were almost 13 times more likely to die than their Washington counterparts of the same age, gender, and race.
That is amazing, though. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think a lot of it is related to drug use and drug overdose. So I think this is a population with a high underlying medical conditions of having drug dependent. So they may return to drugs using the same dose of drugs they might have used before their time in prison, and therefore be at particular risk for drug overdose because they've lost some tolerance.
But you also write that some of the drug overdoses, which were classified as such, may actually have been suicides. It's hard to tell the difference?
It is hard to tell. It's very hard to sort out which were truly accidental overdoses and which were suicides. We used classifications from the National Center for Health Statistics and commonly used diagnoses codes, but this is not an exact science.
Well, the other deaths, homicides in particular, is it because, as one might expect, someone might go back into the violence that sent them to jail in the first place?
I think that's most likely be true. People probably often return to the communities, and the conditions may be the same there as they were prior to their incarceration.
Well, you just did the study, as you said, in Washington State. Can it be generalized to the rest of the country?
To the extent that the characteristics of inmates in other parts of the country are similar to those in Washington State, and to the extent that the reasons why they went to prison to begin with, and also the ways that they're released back into the community are similar, we suspect that the results are generalizable to other states. What we really don't know is whether these results are generalizable to jails, which would make the numbers much higher.
What do you mean, jails as opposed to prisons?
Well, yeah, jails as opposed to prisons. Jails are generally for shorter-term sentences or people who have not yet been sentenced of a crime. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there are many more people who interact with the jail system than interact with the prison system.
Mm-hmm. You are doing the research, but what do you think the take-home is? Do you think there needs to be more transitional care for these people?
Well, I think we need to evaluate the programs that are taking place to help prisoners transition back into their families and back into their communities in light of health outcomes. So do these actually result in decreased deaths during this transitional program? We really don't know very much about that yet, and we're hoping to research more about it. Ideally, what we'd like to look at is, what are the risk factors for death after release from prison? Can we identify these people before they leave prison so that we can intervene and try to prevent them from dying in the immediate post-release period? And after that, we need to find out, well, how can we design programs or policies that might improve this transition back into the community?
Well, and some might say, well, who cares? You know, I mean, you know, given that these are people who had served a long time in prison, putting that aside, if you don't care about what happens to these people, how much does society care considering how much money is put into their prison time?
Well, my feeling is, as a physician, that I need to know what conditions are most likely to put my patients at risk. So this study can help me as a physician who works in the community and does treat people who have been incarcerated in the past to help direct my care to the conditions most likely to harm them. I think from a societal perspective, we incarcerate many people in the United States, and so this problem is likely to affect a lot of families and a lot of communities.
Well, and if someone's thinking, well, that doesn't affect me outside of whatever emotion it provokes, it does, doesn't it? Because we pay for the incarceration of people for years at a time. The hope is that they're rehabilitated, not three times more likely to die when they leave.
Well, we are likely to pay for their health care both while they're incarcerated and after they're released, because many of these individuals don't have health insurance when they're released from prison. Therefore, they end up in the public sector, where really we are likely to be picking up the bill for them both during and after release from prison. We'd like to know that the care that they're receiving is the best quality of care that we possibly can give for the amount of money that we're spending on it.
By the way, doctor, how many people who are perhaps wrongly incarcerated, in other words, they're mentally ill, and perhaps there might have been another option for them, do you know how they fare in that population that dies more quickly after they leave prison? Do you know how mental illness factors into that?
Well, I suspect that mental illness is a big factor in this, because the number of people who die of suicide is quite high, and the rates of death from suicide are quite high after release from prison. Therefore, I think a lot of those people are likely to have had an underlying mental illness, and I suspect that for people with mental illness, the transition between prison and the community can be quite a stressful one, because they need to find housing, employment, they need to secure access to health care, and, you know, hopefully make contact with a doctor who can continue their psychiatric medicines when they're released from prison.
And to give us a sense of how much of a population this affects, we heard a number the other day on the program, and I wanted to check it with you. Someone said that 1 in 75 American males are in prison, and I think that number is higher for African-American males.
Well, there's a very disproportionate rate of incarceration for African-American men and for Hispanic men or Latino men. So I think this is absolutely true that the number of people incarcerated in the United States is very high, and it's even higher for African-Americans and Latinos.
Dr. Binswanger, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Ingrid Binswanger is a researcher at the University of Colorado at Denver and the lead author on a new study that found that inmates, 2 weeks after their release from prison, were 13% more likely to die than their non-prison counterparts. Well, this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, congressional hearings on the plight of Iraqis seeking refuge in the U.S. begins. Also, the trial of former Cheney aide Lewis Scooter Libby opens. We'll have reports on both. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Hung, it's Here and Now. An official and disturbing Iraqi video of the side-by-side hangings of two former top aides to Saddam Hussein shows one man's lifeless body dangling from a rope, the other's falling to the floor, his head coming to a rest a few yards away. An Iraqi official said the decapitation was a rare incident, and the video has only been shown to reporters. But Sunni leaders are expressing outrage and demanding that it be aired. Well, we've seen the power of video from Iraq, and it's something Brian Conley is well aware of. An American filmmaker, Brian wanted to make a documentary about the war, but instead decided to let Iraqis tell their own story. His website is Alive in Baghdad. It's a compilation of short videos made by Iraqis with the cameras Brian gave them. And I asked him, first of all, what's the difference between his video website, or vlog, and the thousands of written online blogs?
You know, if you look at sort of this entity or this phenomenon of blogging, right, it's kind of like whatever your passion is, whatever your feelings about the war, you can find a blog that reflects what you have to say. Mm-hmm. And I feel like with text, it's much easier to go and sort of get your fix and, you know, get riled up and say, that's right, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's really bad news, you know. And with video, we hope that maybe we can push people a little more and that they'll sort of say, well, I don't agree with what this person's saying, but maybe they have a connection. You know, there's a story about a mother tells a martyr's story. And it's this woman who's basically talking about her son who, you know, was an insurgent or a resistance fighter and was killed probably by the Americans. And, you know, we even had people commenting on it who sort of said that, you know, I don't really agree with this woman's position or her son, but there she is. She's a mother, and she's representing herself and the loss of her son.
And so it was just for that alone, the purity of it was what people appreciated. Well, you have two key citizen journalists now, Issam Rashid and Bashir. Mm-hmm. And they have the cameras, and they go around and talk to people?
Yeah, exactly. Issam, you know, we're really lucky to have Issam and Bashir. We think it's going to be a good relationship, but we've just started working with him.
Right. Well, Issam talks on one clip about how his family was caught in the middle of a gun battle between the Mahdi militia and the U.S. and Iraqi soldiers.
Suddenly, I found myself in front of them, and my car in front of them. And my wife, my daughter, was with me in the car. And they start shooting into my car.
What are the concerns that you have? You know, you've given a camera to an Iraqi in Iraq. You're here. How do you make that work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's built a lot on trust, you know, and I think it's built a lot on the fact that we've delivered, you know. When somebody does an interview with us, that it's a risk to them. So by trying to get the footage out as quickly as we can and ensuring them that, look, you know, the risk was worth it because now people are hearing about what happened in their lives.
Well, in fact, his assistant, Issam Rashid's assistant, was killed, wasn't
mm-hmm.
he?
Al-Adl, yep.
How was he killed?
Apparently he was shot in the head. It's believed he was shot by a U.S. sniper, although it's never really been verified. And he was just on his way to work. You know, he was an assistant to Issam for Alive in Baghdad, but he also was working with Issam on some other projects. I think on this day they were building, you know, putting together packages of food for Ramadan to give to the poor. And he was on his way to Assam's house to sort of you know, start assembling the packages and was in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know.
Well, in fact, and people can go to your website, Alive in Baghdad, and just click onto a lot of these videos. There's one, for instance, that's sort of a montage of some of the stories from 2006.
Mm-hmm.
But I was struck, you know, much of it is just things exploding and people yelling or people celebrating, just this sort of montage of Iraq. But at one point, there's a man telling a story about how a body was found with a screw drilled through his entire head, you know, bolted under his chin. I'm not sure we would get that description if somebody wasn't talking to a fellow Iraqi. What do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think you'd be surprised at what Iraqis want to tell internationals if they're willing to listen. And, you know, it's interesting about the sort of ideas about torture and the, you know, complicity of the Iraqi government and things like that. There are all sorts of stories. There are thousands of stories in Iraq, and there are thousands of stories being circulated by Iraqi human rights groups and all these things for well over a year. You know, and there've always been kind of concerns about the Iraqi government that's in power. And for whatever reason, you know, the mainstream press just hasn't picked them up, hasn't followed them. I don't know if it's because they're not capable, if it's, you know, some people would say it's because they're complicit. I'm not willing to go that far.
Do you think it's because they're so busy trying to figure out policy that, I mean, we often hear from listeners who say, why don't we hear more of the anecdotal stories? But, you know, the journalists we know who are risking their lives in Baghdad are often just trying to figure out what's the direction of the war.
Yeah, honestly, I think it's because the press isn't willing to, you know, take the chance to train Iraqis and get Iraqis to be doing the work. The people who are, I mean, Iraq has had a large population of engineers and doctors and scientists, like really educated people. Maybe they're not journalists, but they're educated in critical thinking. And I think those people could have been put to work as journalists and covering the war, you know, several years ago, and we'd be in a very different place than we are now.
Do you worry you're not on the ground as sometimes a correspondent is, so you're not sifting through, you know, 50 stories to figure out which one really represents what's going on? You have Isam and Bashir taping the stories. Do you worry about, you know, putting up propaganda on the website? Do you worry that maybe it's not really representative, even if it's provocative and, you know, powerful?
Sure. I mean, it's always a concern. You know, I try to have a pretty sort of direct connection with the guys in Iraq. I was in Jordan this summer, and I, you know, saw some of them then. And, you know, I always try to push them to say, hey, you know, we need to interview as many people as we can. If we're going to talk about a contentious subject, we should try to get another perspective on it. Until now, you know, we're primarily focusing on really personal stories. And so the question is, believe it or don't believe it, but this is what someone's, you know, perspective or someone's experience is. And we try to put it that way. And a lot of times in the text, I try to sort of put a counter to something. You know, for example, we interviewed Saleh Mutlaq, who's an influential Sunni politician, but I never met a single Iraqi, Sunni or Shia, who had anything good to say about him. We just felt it was important to interview him as a politician, and look, we're just a video blog, and yet, you know, we have access to this person who we never see on, you know, national television, international television.
Well, your dispatches or your correspondence dispatches from the Live in Baghdad website were only disrupted once, momentarily delayed, when you were arrested in Mexico. What were you doing in Mexico?
In Mexico, we're trying to start a similar project, aliveinmexico.org, that'll be, you know, very similar, sort of citizen journalists in Mexico.
But, why were you arrested?
Well, I was in Oaxaca, and you know, there was a lot of sort of social unrest, and there had been some targeting of foreigners, especially foreign journalists and documentary filmmakers. And I think that there was some sort of mix-up, essentially. And, you know, because I had been doing some coverage and I'd been seen around with a camera, they felt I was a person of interest. Even the magistrate who sort of read through the charges and sentenced out the 300 peso fine, you know, even sort of accepted that it was pretty much bunk.
Brian Conley, again, creator of Alive in Baghdad, and now Alive in Mexico. Will there be Alives elsewhere?
I hope so. We're looking to I'm going to be traveling through Africa probably this summer. We're also looking at possibly expanding some other bureaus in the Middle East and Syria or Palestine or places that we have some good contacts already. And, you know, I'm really interested in a lot of other sort of underreported places like Haiti, Chechnya certainly, but that's going to be really very serious endeavor if that happens. Basically all over the world there are places that we need to know more about, and I think we'll know more about them more effectively from the citizens themselves than from foreigners sort of trying to go in and talk about it.
You're listening to Here and Now. how much would you pay for a view of a mountain, a river, a forest? Homeowners in New Hampshire say those views are costing them dearly. Property tax assessors in New Hampshire have begun to break down how much a view increases a home's value. And of course, the more a house is worth, the more the homeowner pays in property taxes. In some cases, lakefront homeowners have been charged for each window that faces the water. Farmers are being charged for uninhabited barns. And a blind man was taxed for a view he can't even see. In a moment, we hear from an opponent of the so-called view tax. But first, we go to Tom Holmes, an assessor in Conway, New Hampshire. And Tom, we know because of a recent court ruling having to do with school funding, property is being assessed more frequently in New Hampshire. But aren't views always taken into account when assessing property?
Well, they always should have been taken into account. The state constitution has mandated that properties be assessed at least as often as every 5 years. And the court decision that occurred concerning school funding interpreted that to be assessed at market value.
How do you assess a view?
Well, a lot of communities use a match pair analysis.
What's that?
Well, basically, it's comparing sales in a given neighborhood from the bottom of the hill to the top of the hill, say, and interpreting through the actions of buyers and sellers what they are paying for and what the premiums they're willing to apply for beneficial views.
So at the top of the hill where you can see further, the houses are worth more?
Well, the buyers tell you that.
And is this, you know, sort of statewide, every assessor sort of follows the same thinking?
They all follow the same thinking because they all have to have the same result. They're supposed to be assessing to market value when they do a revaluation. In some of the smaller communities that don't have a lot of sales, there's a problem that's arising because you may be hanging your hat on just one or two sales to determine the values of these views.
How much is aesthetics a part of it? You know, the fact that one assessor might like a view better than the other, is that a part of it?
I'm not trying to bring my own biases into an assessment. And most good assessors, that's the way they're going to be. They're going to be like baseball umpires. It doesn't matter which team they like. They're just trying to call proper balls and strikes.
Well, local communities in New Hampshire raise most of their revenue from property taxes. There's no state income or sales tax. So a lot of people are complaining that, you know, those with a view are carrying, you know, pretty much the state. Do you have any sympathy for people who say, I can't help it. I just, you know, I happen to live next to Mount Monadnock?
Well, I have a great deal of sympathy for people whose taxes go up dramatically in a short period of time. If somebody's asking to have the view removed from their assessment and it brings their value below what they could sell their property for, that's going to be at the expense of everyone else who's assessed at market value because the tax rate's going to go up to compensate because the town still has to collect the same amount of money that the voters have ordered it to collect.
Tom Holmes is a property assessor in Conway, New Hampshire, talking about this new so-called view tax. Tom, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, we turn now to another Tom, Tom Thompson. His father was a former Republican governor in New Hampshire, and Tom now leads the Axe the View Tax campaign. Why do you want to kill the view tax?
Let me start first by referring to the New Hampshire Assessing Reference Manual, which states not once but numerous times property tax must be fair and equitable. It is not fair, and it is not equitable.
What's not fair about it? As Tom Holmes says, they base it on what people will pay for a view.
Let me just turn to what was said in a legislative hearing by one assessor. He was asked how he defines a view, and he said, I use the wow factor. And the legislator wanted some clarification on that. And what do you mean? And he said, I get in front of the house, I look at the view, and if I can say wow, then that person's going to get a view assessment.
Well, and some people would say, what's wrong with that? I mean, if I can see Crawford Notch, if I can see some of these beautiful views in New Hampshire, I'm going to pay more for it.
Before we start assessing people for $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, as much as $600,000, because that's what the governor just got assessed for, his view in Hopkinton, how can we assess people for a view when we don't even have a clear, concise definition of what a view is? That's my argument.
Well, as you well know, the state legislature there in New Hampshire is taking up this issue with several bills proposed to either axe the view tax or reduce it in some way. What do you think would be fair?
You need to come up with a clear, concise definition of what a view is. There are a number of bills in the legislature, and probably one of the most important ones, and I know Tom is not going to agree with this along with other assessors. Assessors are one of the very few professionals in the state of New Hampshire that are not licensed. That is an absolute must in this state if we want fair and equitable taxation.
Tom Thompson heads the Axe the View Tax campaign in New Hampshire. He wants to prevent property assessors there from increasing the value of a person's home based on their view. We also spoke with Tom Holmes. He's an assessor in Conway, New Hampshire. Tom, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Back in your old neighborhood, the cigarettes taste so good. Just so misunderstood. You're so misunderstood.
And that's the song Misunderstood from Wilco's latest CD. And despite the song title, this is a band that seems to have no trouble getting its message across. Without much radio play, and at one point without even a record label, the Chicago-based group has carved out a critically acclaimed 10-year career that includes a Grammy Award. Wilco's leader is Jeff Tweedy. He recently joined us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. The new Wilco CD is a live recording called Kicking Television. And on it, you can hear the connection between the band and its fans. They know the words. They sing along to the songs. So I asked Jeff Tweedy whether he really feels misunderstood.
I really have no idea if we're understood or not. I don't think it's really our job to know. But certainly the people that come see us play understand something about what they're there for, and I think it's to have a good time in spite of all of the negativity in the lyrics and the music.
We should give some context, too. Wilco is a band that was dropped by its label after the label felt an album wasn't commercial enough. You relaunched the album on the internet. It was so successful that the label had to buy the record back for more than they originally offered you.
A different label, but owned by the same parent company.
Right.
Yes.
So real nya-nya there. And I don't know, it seems to telegraph how important the fan base is to Wilco.
What Wilco has done over the years more than anything is tour and play live shows, and it's pretty much how we've maintained our livelihoods is through our performances. And being so persistent over the years, a hardcore following of fans has kind of developed and grown up around the band. There's a community of people that seem to be involved in the band on the internet and at our shows and follow us around and do a lot of that. So, yeah, I don't know. Over the years, it's worked out that there's been a lot of goodwill between us and our audience.
Especially, as you said, on the internet. And I want to ask you about that, because in some ways that sets you apart from other artists on the issue of downloading and free music. Wilco puts bonus songs on the net. Now, you were asked by Wired Magazine about how you felt about this, and I'm paraphrasing here, but you said a court decision to ban music sampling that's not licensed is sort of like racism.
Well, that was a little inflammatory, probably. I think it totally flies in the face of what music is for, and as a band, we've always tried to be heard, and the internet is just another way for our band to be heard.
Let's talk about what people are listening to, both on the internet and on this new CD in particular. I just want to ask, we heard a little of the song Misunderstood. For those who are not familiar with Wilco, and one or two, we just don't want to give the wrong impression about the sound of the band, because it rocks. In this song in particular, it just busts open, and there seems to be a little bit of not a new guitar sound, but a bigger guitar sound. Let's listen.
I think ultimately we've always considered ourselves a rock band, and that's part of the joy of being in a rock band, is being loud.
Our guess is that you've shaken off that alternative country label.
No, surprisingly not. I keep thinking with each record that it might go away, but then ultimately I see reviews that use that phrase a lot. It doesn't really bother me anymore. It is what it is.
What is it to you? How would you categorize Wilco?
Oh, I think it's just fine with me just to be a rock band. I know that people don't really know what that means anymore, but that was kind of the beauty of it in the past to me, was that rock music was this giant umbrella for all kinds of different things. There were elements of country music, elements of soul music. It was all kind of about a feeling and a spirit and an attitude towards life. And for me, I think just being a rock band is all I really have ever aspired to be. So that's what I would use.
Well, in fact, let's listen to a little more from CD that sort of borrows its title anyway from another genre. Let's listen to Heavy Metal Drummer.
I sincerely miss those heavy metal bands. They used to
Jeff Tweedy, we have something we have to ask you because we're concerned. We heard an interview you did with Minnesota Public Radio where you said you feel like you're playing on borrowed time. And then Wired Magazine called you the haunted Jeff Tweedy.
I'm sitting here across from my wife and she's rolling her eyes at me. She like continues, you know, keeps rolling her eyes about the ghost part or the haunted part. But the borrowed time part, I think, you know, as a band, we talk about it all the time. I think we've kind of outlived the normal lifespan of a band mm-hmm. at this point. Wilco's been around for 10 years. Not a lot of bands get to make records for 10 years, and not a lot of bands get to have their records become more popular as they get older and weirder, which is what is, you know, happened with Wilco. So I think that we feel very fortunate that things have turned out this way, and I guess just try and make every effort that we can to not take it for granted.
Jeff Tweedy of Wilco, which is apparently a family affair, his wife rolling her eyes at him there in the studio. And we know your young son, Spencer, played drums on one of the songs at a recent show.
I've been doing some solo touring, and my wife and my two boys have come out on the road with me a little bit. And when Spencer's allowed to stay up late and come to the shows, he sits in on I'm the Man Who Loves You.
We'll go out with that song from Kicking Television, but as we let you go, the title, Kicking Television, should it be, is it self-evident?
I do think television is a pretty damaging, prevalent part of our society that I think does very little good for anybody. But I also think that it's really fun to watch TV.
Jeff Tweedy, thanks so much.
Thank you. All right, off to the Lego store.
Oh. Something really important.
Oxy is black and white and white and pink, red's blue. Between the words I've been gonna pitch, all's me no sound. You can tell if they bring my heart way I want it when I started writing a set of you. Yeah, I could, you know, I would just hold your hand if you understand.
And this note before we go, oh dang, we'd promised a piece on a terrific classical music program for black and Hispanic kids. Well, the dog ate our homework. Actually, technical gremlins got it. We'll bring that to you tomorrow. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Managing editor Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. And today we welcome listeners from Oregon Public Broadcasting, from Albany to Wagon Tire and Portland in between. I promise I will say Oregon. Thank you, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.